This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. It is 2:30 p.m.
That you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
If they keep on polluting the earth, then tell me where we gonna plant our seed. It makes me wanna cry for the children. Makes me wanna cry for Mother Earth. Makes me wanna cry for we could do. There's so much we could know if we listen to the earth.
And clean air and water are healthy air and water. Every day is Earth Day. I'm Ken Gale.
And we have Sally Gellert, and I'm Donna Stein, and this is Ecologic for March 18th, 2022.
When your air or water are clean, thank an environmentalist. If not, become one. Enough said.
Russia turned off the power to the Chernobyl nuclear plant during their invasion of Ukraine, and our first thought was what happens when radioactive waste overheats. Sally, you're breaking up. Kevin Kams from Beyond Nuclear and Tim Judson from NIRS, NIRS, are here to explain the dangers. Please introduce yourselves. Kevin?
Hello, everybody. My name is Kevin Kams, and I serve as radioactive waste specialist at Beyond Nuclear, based here in Tacoma Park, Maryland.
And hi, all. This is Tim Judson. I'm with Nuclear Information and Resource Service, and I'm actually located in Syracuse, New York, but NIRS is headquartered in also in Tacoma Park, Maryland.
So what were you thinking when they turned off the power? Tim, we'll start with you.
Well, I mean, Russia's entire invasion of Ukraine and war on Ukraine has been, you know, just an exercise in unconscionable recklessness. And, you know, the fact that they've even been conducting a military operations, you know, around nuclear facilities, just inherently risks disaster. And then, you know, by actively occupying these sites with Russian military forces, you know, it's incredibly irresponsible and dangerous. And so, you know, when they took the additional step to shut off the power to the Chernobyl site, you know, it just confirmed the complete, you know, sort of carelessness and recklessness with which Russia's acting.
Kevin?
Well, the news was heart-stopping and terrifying and terrorizing, and I think that's part of the point, perhaps, of the Putin regime. The good news, I guess, at Chernobyl is that there is enough water in the indoor wet storage pools for the long-cooled and decayed high-level radioactive waste in there that the fuse is much longer than would otherwise be the case at an operating reactor, for example. So even without power, there may be a week or weeks or even months before the fuel would be on fire. And when I say the fuel being on fire, such a pool fire would likely dwarf many of the accidents we're going to talk about today in terms of radioactivity release to the living environment. And just the example I'd like to give for that is Fukushima Daiichi Unit 4, 11 years ago, came incredibly close to a pool fire, and it was sheer luck that it didn't happen. And don't take it from me, take it from the Japanese Prime Minister serving at the time, Naoto Kan, who a year after the Fukushima catastrophe began was willing to speak publicly about his plans, a secret contingency plan to evacuate up to 50 million people from northeastern Japan if that Unit 4 pool had caught on fire. And he summed it up by saying that would have been the end of the Japanese state. And like I said, it only did not occur through sheer luck.
Wow.
Yeah, and I think to underscore what Kevin was just saying about the danger of Chernobyl, you know, nuclear power plants have very strict regulations about the storage and handling of flammable and explosive materials on reactor sites. So with Russian military actually occupying the Chernobyl site and the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant site, with military vehicles, tanks, with munitions, the danger that something could go wrong, even without the power being shut off, you know, to the Chernobyl site, the chances that explosions could actually damage these facilities and cause the kind of disaster Kevin was just talking about is just inherent in what Russia's doing.
The Kyshtym nuclear waste explosion from the Soviet Union, I mean, it wasn't reported, even though it would have been a propaganda victory if the U.S. had talked about it. Could you guys go into what happened there? Kevin.
Well, Kyshtym in the Soviet Union was one of three large-scale nuclear disasters that took place in the months of September, October 1957. There was another one at Windscale in the United Kingdom, and yet another one at Rocky Flats, Colorado. All of that took place within the same month, essentially, in 1957. And at Kyshtym in Siberia, in the Urals, at Chelyabinsk, this was a Soviet reprocessing facility extracting plutonium from high-level radioactive waste for use in its nuclear weapons arsenal. And there's liquid high-level radioactive waste that is a byproduct of that activity. And it was being stored in a large tank, a gigantic tank, and it lost cooling. And the heat built up and explosives ignited. And it was probably up to that point the largest release of ionizing radioactivity in history. And all of this had only just begun with the Manhattan Project in 1942. And it literally wiped hundreds, if not thousands, of human habitations off the map, from hamlets to villages to towns to perhaps even cities. And the CIA knew about it in real time, essentially, at least once those Soviet maps were republished without those human habitations listed on them. But a long tradition of the CIA and the KGB was to cover up for each other's nuclear disasters. And the reason for it, the motivation, was to keep the domestic populations in the dark, lest they ask questions about U.S. nuclear activities in the U.S. or the Soviet population asking about Soviet nuclear activities in the Soviet Union. So the CIA knew about it quickly. They probably detected the radioactivity release that occurred. But we didn't find out as the public worldwide until, I think, 1990, when a book was published called Nuclear Disaster in the Urals by a Soviet dissident.
Well, I knew about it when I started becoming politically active in 1980, but not quite the breadth of the destruction. And I remember hearing at some lecture I went to that they detected the explosion at the Lamont-Dougherty Geologic Lab, which is on the Hudson River in New Jersey. So that's quite an explosion. They didn't know what the explosion was. because of the secrecy both here and there. But it's amazing where something as huge as an explosion that kills all those people is successfully kept secret for such a long time. And when we sent out our publicity for this show, we listed a bunch of accidents, and I realized that we don't know them all. I'm sure some of them they've succeeded in keeping secret. And it just really angers me when I think of people who call themselves environmentalists who are pro-nuclear because they don't know about and don't want to know about whether it's routine releases or an accident like this. I mean, it's horrible. And we all have our you know, I've asked Kevin and Tim, it's like, look, you know a lot of different things. So, you know, choose what you feel is the most dramatic in your feelings. Tim, let's start with you.
Well, I think the thing that, you know, that also distinguishes, you know, these type of disasters and you know, and then the various impacts of nuclear power is that these accidents don't really end, right?
I mean,
it persists in the environment, you know, for, you know, I mean, hundreds, if not thousands of years. And so, you know, we're 30 years into the, you know, more than 30 years into the Chernobyl disaster. And, you know, then there's still a, you know, 1,000 square mile uninhabitable zone. You know, there's still, you know, tens of thousands of people in Japan who, you know, haven't returned to their homes from Fukushima. And Fukushima is still, you know, the melted down reactors are still, you know, still leaking hundreds of thousands of gallons of contaminated water a day into the Pacific Ocean. So, you know, these are really disasters that don't really end. You know, we can put a date on when they started, but we don't have a date for when they're going to end.
Yeah, people often tend to think that, you know, a reactor's closed, so it's not dangerous anymore. And it's not exactly true.
Not at all true.
No, I mean, every nuclear power plant site is a radioactive waste dump, right? The soil becomes contaminated, the local water supplies become contaminated. And there's not, you know, while the companies are required to, you know, to quote clean them up after, you know, after the plant shuts down, you know, in most cases they actually haven't been able to clean them up completely. There's still radiation left over.
Yeah. So not only do we not know about all the accidents, we don't know just how bad they have been.
Yeah. No, when we were making our list of accidents over the decades, and it was mind-boggling. There's people here know that there's been a lot of accidents. Our listeners are pretty educated, but
right.
You would still be surprised. Every single one of you listening right now would be surprised at how many there are. And we have to know that it's an ongoing problem. Every single accident is going to be there longer and more destructive, longer than us and our children. What happens to the people who are in the vicinity? Like the Russian soldiers were just marched into the area of Chernobyl. What happens to them?
Well, I mean, one of the first things we learned during the first days of the invasion was that radiation monitoring stations, which are remotely operated and then transmit their data automatically in the Chernobyl exclusion zone, many stations went from green to red, which meant that the control levels were being violated. And the assumption to this point, but we still don't know for sure, is that it was radioactive dust being kicked up in the local ecosystem by tanks and armored personnel carriers and troop trucks and, you know, the Russian invasion. And like Tim said, there are very strict rules at operating nuclear power plants, at closed nuclear power plants in the Chernobyl exclusion zone for how people are supposed to behave, how they're supposed to move around. And of course, the Russian military has completely violated all those rules. And even the Ukrainian Nuclear Safety Agency explicitly stated that. So, and certainly there was radioactive dust kicked up. And one reading I saw in those first days was 1 millirem per hour. And if you're exposed to such a thing for a year, that would be close to 10 rem per year, which is a very high exposure. But these are external exposures to things like gamma, which is bad enough. But those Russian troops, unless they're wearing respiratory protection, which they're not, the 211 workers at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant who've been held hostage since February 24th, the inhabitants, and there are inhabitants in the Chernobyl exclusion zone, mostly elderly people who are from there, who snuck back in and want to live out their last days there, but there are others there too, desperate people with nowhere else to be. If you inhale a single microgram, a speck of plutonium dust into your lung, you are at risk of lung cancer. It may take 10, 20, 30 years to show itself, but it began when you inhaled this speck of plutonium dust into your lung. So those are some of the kind of risks that everybody in the Chernobyl exclusion zone has been facing these past weeks, elevated risk.
Yeah, and that's given that how long it takes a cancer like that to appear, you know, they'll never be counted as related to there because, right. Well, maybe it was somewhere else or maybe it was this or that. And so it goes uncounted and unrecognized.
Yeah, to prepare for the show, I was reading Anna Georgi's book, No Nukes, Everyone's Guide to Nuclear Power. And it's got an updated version, which I don't have yet, but just the old version talked about all these different accidents that released radioactive water into the drinking water supplies of different cities throughout the United States. You know, Vermont Yankee, three times before 79, put it into the Connecticut River. The drinking water of St. Paul had radioactive water in it. And it's just, and so many other examples like that. They're very cavalier. They're like, oh, well, they just put it in the water. Just get rid of it. Windscale in England in 57 that Kevin mentioned a little while ago, the English government's reaction was to change the name of Windscale so that nobody would know that it's still around. But they had radioactive iodine that contaminated the milk and for 200 miles around, and they confiscated the milk and dumped it into the Irish Sea.
Ugh.
They don't know what to do with it. They make this waste, but they don't know what to do with it.
So we're finding all of this to be pretty depressing. I don't want to say depressing. Kind of a downer. Tim, tell us something positive.
Well, something positive, you know, is that, you know, at least, you know, New York City is, you know, is safer than it used to be because, you know, we finally closed the Indian Point nuclear power plant. And, you know, that's, you know, a major risk reduction to, you know, to the most densely populated place in the country. So, you know, we've got some positive stories like that. The, you know, in the next 3 years, the, you know, the last nuclear power plant in California, Diablo Canyon, is going to be shut down. So, you know, there are positive things that are happening, to reduce the chances of, you know, these disasters going forward. You know, I just think that, you know, as we're seeing in Russia right now or in Ukraine right now, you know, one bad day, is essentially going to affect an entire region for generations.
Right. And that's why it's more of the same. We can be happy that that plants close down, but we have to know that the danger is not over. It's just ameliorated. It's just a little bit better. So, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, there is a decommissioning oversight board for Indian Point, which actually just met last night. Unfortunately, I had to miss the meeting, but having registered, they emailed me and said, you're on the list to speak. So it's better, you know, at least they're paying attention. Whether they have enough power to really oversee it, you know, a bad company that's doing the work, we'll see.
Yeah, we know that Manager Green from Clearwater and Bob Alpern from Kevin's Beyond Nuclear, I think, are part of that group. So, Kevin, tell us something positive. It's your turn to say something we need to hear.
Well, a positive thing along the lines of what Tim just shared is that the Palisades nuclear power plant in Michigan has scheduled and announced its closure by May 31st of this year.
Yay.
But as you just indicated, Sally, the risks continue even post-shutdown into the decommissioning phase. And Holtec International has applied to take over at Palisades. And I wanted to mention a connection between Indian Point and Palisades and Chernobyl, and that is Holtec International. Holtec is in charge of the high-level radioactive waste management at Chernobyl, and in fact for the whole country of Ukraine. And it's even its dry cast storage facility at Chernobyl is very flawed through its own mismanagement. And so it's good that we have watchdogs still at Indian Point and still in Michigan on Holtec, because they are not to be trusted. They are a very crooked company.
Yeah. Sadly, very connected to the New Jersey political machine, and apparently Oyster Creek just moved into the district of Representative Van Drew, who is connected to the Holtec board. So,
so Kevin and Tim, last minute of the show. This goes fast. Anything you want to tell us to finish up the show?
Well, one accident I do want to put on everybody's radar is one of the worst in U.S. history, which is the Rio Porco River in New Mexico.
Yeah.
And a colleague in New Mexico suggested that on a future show, perhaps you could consider having someone from the Redwater Pond Community Association, which is a Navajo Dene shepherd community immediately downstream from this disaster site. It was a uranium mill tailings pond breach of an earthen dam that released a gigantic amount of radioactive wastewater and radioactive sludge and toxic materials into that sole source for the Navajo Dene Shepherds, 1979.
As usual, time flies by and we need to wrap it up, but thanks for joining us. For more information, you can reach Kevin Kamps at www.beyondnuclear.org. That's beyondnuclear.org. And Tim Judson at www.nirs.org. That's NIRS. We're having technical problems here. Join us in 2 weeks on Friday, April 1st.
No fooling?
Really, for a celebration of nature with Abby Hafer talking about unusual animals such as the immortal jellyfish.
We have information on a variety of environmental topics, such as the expected SEC ruling requiring publicly traded companies to disclose greenhouse gas emissions. And to listen to this show or any of our past shows again, it's all at www.ecoradio.org.
That's www.ecoradio.org.
Mainstream media may cover events like these we brought you today, but they'll drop them quickly with little or no follow-up. Their corporate profit interests always move on to the next shiny thing. They don't report on the real ongoing human cost.
WBAI is celebrating Women's History Month. Ecologic is highlighting exceptional women environmentalists. Last week, Jeannie Shaw brought us peace claims and a reminder of ongoing danger. Pacifica has hosted many women of power, and this Sunday on Environment TV on Manhattan Neighborhood Network, 11 a.m., the Ecologic that we did about Connie Hogarth will be broadcast on television.
To keep bringing you these unique programs, Ecologic and WBAI are in need of your support. We really need you to become a BAI buddy in the name of Ecologic. And you will receive a flash drive of Pacifica's Women History Collection and a WBAI tote bag.
Pacifica has a wealth of archival material, including the voices of many powerful women of history. You'll hear Rachel Carson, Helen Caldicott, Mildred Harmon, and many more.
All right, we're having technical.
When you become a BAI buddy with a contribution of $15 a month, we really appreciate it and need your support. Help us to continue to bring you important news, information, and entertainment. Radio might seem free, but there are costs, and our listener-supported radio station needs you.
go to www.woman.wbai.org and choose Ecologic on the drop-down menu after you click on Next, or call 212-209-2950 and say you want to be a member or a BAI buddy. Also, those of you online, please sign up for our email list to stay connected with us. Those of you on social media, search for Eco-Logic.
And thanks to our terrific engineer, Reggie Johnson. We couldn't do this without you. I'm Ken Gale.
And we've got Sally Geller on the line, and I'm Donna Stein. Join us in 2 weeks on Friday, April 1st at 2:30 p.m. to celebrate unusual animals. Thank you so much, Kevin and Tim, for joining us today.
WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. Russian and Ukrainian diplomats are getting closer to an agreement on Ukraine's neutral status, according to the leader of the Russian delegation, who said the two sides have narrowed their differences on Ukraine's desire to join NATO. The delegation leader said the sides are halfway on the question of Ukraine's demilitarization, but the sides appear to remain far apart on the issue of Ukraine's territorial integrity, with Kyiv demanding that Russian-recognized separatist regions in the east remain a part of Ukraine. U.S. President Joe Biden spoke by video link with Chinese President Xi Jinping today in an effort to deter China from providing support to Russia during its invasion of Ukraine. Before the call, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said Biden would question China's, quote, absence of denunciation of Russia's invasion. A Chinese readout of the call condemned conflict and confrontation, but did not explicitly blame Russia. Xi highlighted China's donations of humanitarian aid and accused the U.S. of worsening the conflict by shipping weapons to Ukraine, according to the readout. Weeks before the invasion, Xi and Russian President Vladimir Putin announced a no-limits partnership to counter the West. China has attempted to publicly distance itself from Russia's invasion, but has avoided criticizing it. President Putin addressed a massive nationalist rally at a stadium in Moscow today, praising Russian troops for, quote, giving up one's soul for one's friends. Putin repeated his claim that Russia's invasion of Ukraine was intended to prevent genocide. The rally speech comes just 2 days after Putin issued a video address in which he urged Russians to, quote, distinguish true patriots from scum and traitors, and said a, quote, natural and necessary self-purification of society will only strengthen our country, end quote. At least 130 people have been rescued from the rubble of a theater in the besieged port city of Mariupol after an attack destroyed the building. A Ukrainian human rights official said more than 1,300 people could still be in a bomb shelter in the basement of the building, and said rescue operations are continuing. The word children was written out on two sides of the theater before it was bombed, according to satellite images. Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman said yesterday that the allegation that Russia had bombed the theater was a lie, and repeated Kremlin denials that Russian forces have targeted civilians. At a press briefing today, the UN Refugee Agency announced that more than 3.1 million people have fled Ukraine since Russia launched its invasion, and millions more are internally displaced. In addition to those who have had to flee, the agency said around 13 million people in the areas hardest hit by the war are in dire need of humanitarian and protection assistance. The agency appealed to neighboring countries to continue opening their borders to those fleeing in search of safety. It also drew attention to the increased risk of trafficking and exploitation faced by women and children, who constitute roughly 90% of those who have fled Ukraine. The agency said it is working with partner agencies to raise awareness and alert refugees of those risks.